If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
And some of this book is an exercise in pleasure. I love these places, and it's not all about the hard facts. You know, when I go to somewhere like Flodden Battlefield, I am in awe of the landscape.
That was Neil Oliver talking about his new geographical history of Britain.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, we'll be hearing from Neil Oliver, a historian and archaeologist who's well known for having presented numerous series on BBC television. He's just released his latest book, The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places, and our content director, Dave Musgrove, met up with him to find out more.
So, I'm here with Neil Oliver, archaeologist, TV presenter, writer and author of The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places. Neil, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What were your criteria for deciding the 100 places?
I had been aware for a long time, years, that I was being given a kind of bespoke tour of Britain on account of the kind of television that I was making. And I was aware that I was seeing places, a mix of places, both familiar, famous landmark places, and also other locations that were just so off the beaten track that the vast majority of people would never have heard of them, far less had a chance to visit them. And I was thinking for a long time, I really ought to be keeping a note of this, because I am getting a history of the British Isles that no one else is getting, because it was a chronological spread and a geographical spread, and I thought, this is unique. It's the magic carpet of television in the main, but nonetheless, I'm being shown something here that makes sense. So when it came to choosing a number, I quite shamelessly thought people have done 100 things. There's a familiar ring to this. So I'll go with 100. The 50, the first, let's approximately say, 50 of those were instantly apparent to me because they had registered so strongly with me that I thought that's got to be worth hearing. That should be more broadly known. The second half, I had to distill from many, many hundreds of places. So I took a judicious journalistic approach. I thought, right, where are the gaps? I need to say something about the wars of religion or the English Civil War or the First World War. I need certain things. And so I considered, now, where have I seen or what have I seen that makes a contribution to that story? So some of it was journalistic and others were places like the Fortingall Yew, the tree, or St. Nectan's Glen in Cornwall. I thought, you know, these are remarkable places, wonderful. Go and see them.
So is this a guidebook for places to visit, or is it a construct for telling a narrative story of the British Isles?
My intention, and it'll be up to the readers to decide whether I've hit the mark or not, was to have a narrative arc. It is supposed to be what it says it is, the story of the British Isles, focused through the prism of 100 locations, or in some cases, objects, Magna Carta, Alfred Jewell, the Amesbury Archer, which is not an object, it's a person. But it was places which I felt all strung together did tell a credible story. And there was a way of understanding the evolution of the Britain that we live in today through these 100 places. It's not a gazetteer. it certainly wasn't my intention to be somewhere that you could read it. I would hope that people would just, you know, flick open a page and see what the place is, and each one should stand alone as hopefully an interesting tale about the place in its own right. But my overarching intention was to tell the history of Britain in an idiosyncratic, personal way.
It's not a gazetteer, and neither is it a top 100. Like, the number one is the earliest.
No,
it's chronological.
It's chronological, but I'm not saying that, you know, it doesn't count down like the charts in the old days. It's not, you know, this is the 100th best down to the number one. No.
Yeah. Now, you talked a little in the conclusion of the book about the minefield of the current political makeup of the British Isles, and that's probably in part why you've chosen to use the British Isles in the title. Did you feel any under any pressure to kind of spread out your places across the various polities of the British Isles that exist today?
I was mindful of it, but I didn't let it dictate too much of the choices that I made. Happily, I think I can genuinely say, I say in the introduction, that there were numerous times over the years where I would think, surely there aren't many people that have seen as much of the archipelago as me. I thought, who would you have to be? What would your job be that you would have been taken north, south, east and west so many times and had the opportunity to see? It can only be me. So I have seen a lot of places. I'm not making it up. I've been all over Ireland. I've been all over Wales. I've been all over England. I've been all over Scotland. I've been to extremities like Orkney, Shetland, the Channel Islands, Faroe. I've been all over the place. So I had to sort of focus my choices, but it wasn't a struggle. Although I was mindful, I thought, well, because everywhere does have part of the story. You can't tell the story of the British Isles without looking at the way historical events unfold in each of the polities. So, but it wasn't difficult, and it's not artificial. I have been to these places, and the vast majority of them registered with me very, very strongly. Some more than others, but a lot of these places really struck me as being places of significance.
And how hard did you find it? You talked about trying to use it as a way to tell the narrative of the British Isles, and as you said, there are difficulties there with the different polities and different stories that are going on. How hard did you find it to try and construct an overarching narrative when there, in a way, isn't, because they diverge at various points?
I found it easy to come up with the narrative that I have come up with. Whether or not people will find it to be a helpful narrative, I cannot say. But it was. A story had suggested itself to me, and it was made of several things. For example, I felt that it can sound silly to say it, but Scotland, England are very old countries. Now, that sounds silly because you think, well, the planet's 5 billion years old. It's always been here. But nonetheless, you know, for example, there has been an entity that is more or less Scotland for about 1,000 years. And the same is more or less true of, say, England. Now, Germany, for example, did not coalesce into what we would consider Germany until a couple of hundred years ago. Likewise, Italy. Italy was an agglomeration of individual states and statelets and cities. It didn't come together as what we would call Italy until much more recently. So these are old countries. And what that gives us is, we have made every mistake in the book in those, certainly in the 1,000 years that there have been, the nations have been identifiable. But for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years before, we have been on a journey that has taught us a great deal. You know, we've had our natural disasters. You know, the country has been overtaken by great natural tragedies. We have known famine. We've known religious war. We've known civil war. We've burned people for being witches or for worshipping God in what would be considered to be the wrong way. And so other countries, which haven't maybe been in existence for as long, can genuinely look at us and think, what happened to them when that tragedy unfolded there? You know, there's a good line about, I wear a suit of armour made only of my mistakes. We have done terrible things to other people. We've done terrible things to ourselves and to each other, and lessons have been learned. And the place that we've arrived at has a lot to teach, because we have weathered a great deal and there is wisdom in what we have been through. And I think that's part of what I think is worth paying attention to the story of the British Isles for. And also, because my natural inclination is, I'm an archaeologist, I get badged as a historian, particularly by television, but I make no claims to being an academic historian. I'm an enthusiast. I don't have a history degree, I've got an archaeology degree. I'm just enthusiastic about historical stories. But my natural inclination towards archaeology has for long made me aware of the fact that the constructs of England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales are incredibly new in the story of the British Isles. The archipelago wasn't even an archipelago until, 8,000 years ago when the Strega Slide separated Britain from mainland Europe. And we get very excited about, the nationhood of Scotland or England or Ireland or Wales. Where at the moment, there isn't a hotter subject than Brexit. And I find when I get very worked up about some of those subjects, I get solace from thinking it's a veneer on something much older. And it's the situation at the moment, but give it 100 years or give it 1,000 years and it will all be very different in ways that we can't even begin to imagine. Just as 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, it was unimaginably different again. And it gives a perspective to however febrile and insoluble today's situation can feel. You think, well, we've been through everything.
Yeah.
This too shall pass, as was inscribed on a ring worn by Solomon,
Okay, so I too trained as an archaeologist, which is why I particularly enjoyed the sections at the start of the book, which cover prehistory, and I found it very very fascinating. And I always think I've got this romantic view of the Mesolithic, the time before the farmers came here. It sounds to me like a sort of place I'd like to have been. Yeah, you're hunting, gathering, you're generally having a nice time. There's not too many people to bother you. And in your section on the first fields in County Mayo, you allude to the fact that's been mentioned in other places as well, that once we started farming, we couldn't stop because we were on that daily grind. And once you've got too much food, then you need to keep making too much food. So do you share my romantic ideal of the Mesolithic?
100%. I at the same time as knowing that once you've got farming and surplus, you've probably got a better chance of being able to continue to feed yourself and your family. That's without a doubt. However, there is definitely a romance to the idea of being a hunter, untrammelled by property, untrammelled by the daily grind. And I'm sure, as I say in the book, I'm sure there were times, maybe for a whole lifetime of a given group, the living may well have been good. If the climate was in your favour, and if the wild fruits ripened, and if the wild animals and the fish were there at the right times, then there was a good life to be had. But there would also been terrible times. And when the times went bad, there was no safety net. There was no surplus. And so they would have known starvation. They must have been managing their reproductive. They must have been managing how many children they had, because you can't have half a dozen children in each couple if the tribe is on the move. They must have been doing something, some kind of birth control, infanticide or whatever. They must have been managed, so they had challenges to overcome. And then there were the physical dangers. You're hunting wild animals, some of them capable of hurting you back. But yes, I share absolutely the idyll of the farmer. I think it must have been, I think one of the lines I use in the book is it must have been a tough sell. If you approached hunters in the good times and said, what you want to do is cut down all these trees, dig up all these roots, and spend the next rest of your life tending those fields. And on the flip side, you can eat porridge and bread. It's a tough sell to people that are maybe living on wild game and the fruits of the forest, and that if they get fed up with the view out the window, they can move on.
Though we all like porridge, so...
But not three times a day.
And you talk a little on the section about Grimes Grave, the Neolithic flint mine, that the miners seem to have been careful to backfill once they'd exhausted it, and you sensed that perhaps that meant that they were feeling that they needed to renew the earth once they'd worked it. Do you feel perhaps that people in the past were better custodians of this land than we are now? And if so,
when did we start to become irresponsible?
I'll start answering that question by saying, in this book, because it's my story, I allowed myself a certain amount of creative license. I wanted to give myself rein to imagine and consider what ifs that people might well dispute. And while I did say, and I do stand by, the idea that the evidence does at least suggest the possibility that people there were being very judicious about how they were exploiting the resource. Now, a lot of it might have been very practical. I mean, maybe if they had had subsidence and land collapses on account of, they might have thought, well, we can't just create this endless honeycomb under the ground, it's dangerous. So some of what they were doing might have been purely practical. Let's just have a couple of things open at a time, and when we're finished, we'll backfill them and it'll keep everything stable. But nonetheless, excavation has shown that there were little effigies, little figures, things that looked like ritual deposits. Some flint pieces were put back down for no apparently logical, practical reasons. There was some other thinking going on. And I think it's definitely reasonable to suggest that they were mindful. And I do hold to the idea that for people who are harvesting the wild resources, that they may have made no distinction between, you know, the necessity to, by taking flint out of the ground, that there might have been some concept that you had to return some of it in order to keep it coming. They wouldn't have been able to conceive of what made the flint, what the flint was made of, why it was there, and it may have made sense to them to think, well, we better keep a reciprocal quid pro quo going on with the natural environment. In answer to your question, I think we, however, if whether they were being big-hearted, wise custodians of the earth, it's hard to say. That's putting our thinking back thousands of years, and that's always a dangerous thing to do. But I would think that we possibly became less careful custodians when, as population starts to grow and the necessity for raw materials begins to outstrip concerns about the way in which it's being acquired. You know, if you've got more and more people needing these things, and if there's more and more, I don't want to use the word money, but if you can build up your account of status and wealth and prestige and authority by producing more and more of this, either this raw material or the finished objects, then that might have begun to outweigh the softer considerations of we ought to be repaying the debt. And we stopped repaying the debt, but I think there was definitely a time for a long time during the exploitation of stone and the early exploitation of metals, I think people were thinking there's an account being kept, and we should settle debts and pay things back. And that got swamped by numbers.
You talk at various places, particularly when you're thinking about the prehistoric sites you mentioned, that you feel a sense of the thin line between past and present, which is quite an interesting thing to say for an archaeologist. I don't know how your archaeological friends might think about that. Normally, when there's an archaeological question, it comes down to it's religion or things like that aren't discussed that widely. So, what are you trying to say there? What's your sense?
I think it's important and valid to use your imagination. Certainly, you don't want to get too carried away with it. And I always try to balance the two. I try and lay out how the facts have been interpreted in a more cold-blooded, observational, scientific manner. But I think there's also room to speculate. I was involved in a television project a few years ago, which has recently resurfaced on television, The Sacred Wonders of Britain. And there was great, I thought, value in we encouraged the archaeologists and others to imagine. Start a sentence with, well, if you're asking me, I think. And I think encouraging people to think about what may always be unknowable is valid. There are certain things about the archaeological past that we will never be able to prove conclusively because we don't have enough hard data. And there's always got to be room for some speculation. And I think it's valuable because I think it reminds us that we're across the thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. You know, we have been Homo sapiens for 200,000 years, and we have a lot of things in common with people from the past, physical and our mental cognitive abilities. And while it's lethally dangerous to try and think that you can put yourself back into the mindset of a Neolithic farmer or a Mesolithic hunter or an Iron Age smith. I think where there's an absence of hard information, it's still valid to speculate, because we are, after all, still people. And a lot of our motivations and a lot of our responses to outside stimuli are the same now as they would have been 10,000 or 30,000 years ago. And as long as you don't imagine that somebody's speculation is hard fact, I do think it helps to broaden out the bigger picture. You have to invite people to think and say, I can't prove this. I don't know this without, I don't have the scientific data, but my experience of this place has made me consider the possibility that, and I think the other half of that sentence is of value. Mm. It's not science, but it's still valuable to speculate, and I enjoy it. It's part of why I enjoy these places. And some of this book is an exercise in pleasure. I love these places, and it's not all about the hard facts. You know, when I go to somewhere like Flodden Battlefield, I am in awe of the landscape. And in the same way that I feel about, say, the battlefield of Isandlwana in KwaZulu-Natal, because it looks like a stage set for some sort of dramatic event. When I go to Flodden and I look out at it, you think, it really happened here. Exactly why it happened and exactly what happened, we're still working that out, but it happened here. And I find a pleasure in going to, and part of it for me is just saying, what if? What if? And I don't see any harm in it.
Was there something specific that happened to you when you looked at the Dover boat?
Definitely. Yes. I'll say it quite honestly, because it was purely something that I experienced. I don't know if you've been to the Dover boat.
No.
I don't know. It's kept in a special box, a glass box that controls the temperature and the climate within, so that it, you know, it's very carefully managed for obvious reasons to keep the thing going. And I was given the opportunity to unlock the door, step inside, and be beside it. And there was a smell, because the thing's been treated. It is wood, but it's been treated in particular ways. There was an aroma that meant that the room smelled the room with the, or the box with the boat in it, had an atmosphere, both literally and metaphorically. And you could see quite clearly, even to the untutored eye, you could see the cut marks, because this thing had been put out of use. It'd been scuttled, and you could see they'd cut the withies that were holding it together. There were also the marks of its making. You could see where sharp edges had been used to shape and cut off bits of the wood to give it its form. And when I was in the room with it, the hairs went up on my shoulders and neck. Now, whether that's just because I've got a fanciful imagination or whatever, but I had a physical reaction to being in the same room as the boat. And I can remember it still. As I'm talking to you now, I can still catch the outside edges of that sensation. And I thought, why am I feeling this? It's just an artefact. It's just wood. But I felt something. And I thought, well, I did. And I'll report the fact.
We should just say what the Dover boat was.
The Dover boat is exactly what it was found in excavations in Dover in advance of the building of a new road. It was found in a deep cut that was eventually going to be a pedestrian walkway. And it was deep under the modern surface. And this boat, which in its final form was probably, I think, about 60 or 70 feet long. And it was created in a very bizarre way, really. It was neither a dugout canoe, nor was it the kind of planks pinned together in the conventional way that you would think of a boat. They were sewn together. So these massive planks of wood had holes drilled through them, and it was given a shape and a structure with withies, which are thin but flexible pieces of, say, willow or something equally bendy. And it was sewn together. It's a sewn plank boat. It's quite a bizarre creation. But it would have taken a lot of effort to make it, a lot of skill. We presume that the kind of person who could commission it and have enough men to row it, it must have been of high status. And given its location, the likelihood is that it was plying back and forth across the channel to the continent. It's quite an amazing artefact. Only half of it survives because it was a rescue excavation. They were working against the clock. They had to cut. It's like an impacted tooth. You know, they couldn't get it all out in one go, so they just took out part of it. And even the part they got came out in bits, and it was reassembled by the conservators. And it's been treated so that, well, potentially, if it remains in its special box, it could last forever. And it's this extraordinary Bronze Age survival. And to me, and I'm allowed this personal opinion, it was, I thought then, and I have not had any since, it's the best thing I've ever seen. As artefacts go, I have not had a stronger reaction to being in the presence of any other survival from the past. I squatted down beside it and thought, God, I can feel the Bronze Age.
Wow. Well, I better go and see it. That sounds good.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Now, look, we need to leap forward a bit. We covered prehistory a bit. You're not hugely positive, I think it's fair to say, about the contribution of the Romans. How do you feel about the Romans? You don't think they were that good?
Being deliberately controversial. I studied archaeology at Glasgow University. I didn't do any of the Roman papers because at the time, there I was, 17, 18, 19 years old, they sounded then to me a bit dull. They sounded a bit stiff. Mm-hmm. And I was just, because I don't know, just the way I'm wired up, I was much more inclined towards the prehistory. I didn't like the idea that so much of it was written down. I thought it was more of a fun game to try and work out what the Mesolithic hunters had been all about, because they didn't write anything down. You're cheating a bit with the Romans, because they tell you at least some of what they're doing and why. I thought, I'll leave that to the Romanists. So it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, as everyone else. You know, in my sober, sensible moments, I appreciate the glory that was Rome, without a shadow of a doubt. One of the most astonishing manifestations of human intent that the world has yet seen, without a doubt. With a caveat, I think, you know, this whole concept of what the Romans did for us, I like to remind myself and others that there were people here who had a cosmology and a way of doing things, and they were clever, and they were the inheritors, the legatees of thousands of years of history. And they weren't just sitting around in a swamp, Monty Python style, waiting for somebody to come in, show them how the world worked. And I just wanted to be deliberately controversial or provocative, I suppose, in saying that, you know, yes, the Romans were extraordinary, but so were the people that were here already.
But you would still recommend having a look at the Roman baths in Bath?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, for me, the Roman baths are staggering. You know, the fact you can put your hand in that flow of water and think, Roman men and women and children felt this water, it smelt like this, it was this temperature, it was running then, and it's running now, and it'll probably be running forever. It's an amazing place. For me, though, it's Hadrian's Wall. I was getting taken to Hadrian's Wall on school trips. I mean, I remember going there before I knew I wanted to be involved in archaeology and history. I remember going to Housesteads and all the rest of it from I was 10, 11, 12, probably primary school, I think, we had our first school trip to there, because I grew up in Dumfries. Mm. So Hadrian's Wall was accessible. And to me, that's the most emphatic Roman presence in Britain, for me.
Yeah.
I like the wall.
And in your chapter on the wall, you focus particularly on that amazing place with the
sycamore
gap, with the really cool tree.
So, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, it's one of the most photographed places in Britain. It's one of the most popular trees, if there can be such a thing. It wins awards for best tree of the year and such
not?
Like. Yeah. And why not? It featured in the Kevin Costner version of Robin Hood. In a day's march, he gets from the White Cliffs of Dover to later the same day's jumping over Hadrian's Wall, which is a fantastic bit of artistic license. And it's, if you go and see it, I'm sure most people have glimpsed Hadrian's Wall by now, but when you think that someone said, do you know what, we can build a wall from one side of this country to the other, and not just some flimsy wall, a great white lump of masonry that will stretch from east to west and will have forts, and it's extraordinary. Still a wonder to behold.
Right, we're gonna leap forward a bit into medieval period. I've got to allow you to tell us about Stirling Castle, home ground. You live
best castle
nearby,
best castle in Britain.
Best, right? Okay, that's a sweeping statement.
But... I live in Stirling with my wife and our three kids, who are age at the moment 15, 12, and 10. If you live in a certain postcode within Stirling, you're effectively, in terms of ancient statute, within the city walls. So you get to visit the castle for free anytime you want and as many times as you want.
Brilliant.
And so you have to go up to the gates with like a gas bill or something which proves your address. So you get in, and so we go all the time, and we do treasure hunts, and we get the kids, we'll drop a list of things for the kids to spot, and we'll go to different bits of it. We'll go to the Renaissance palace, or we'll go to the battlements, or we'll look at the little porthole that was cut through the battlements for Mary, Queen of Scots, so that she could look out as a toddler without being spotted by Henry VIII's agents prowling below when Henry was trying to get hold of her for a bride for his son. And it's just... Edinburgh Castle gets much more publicity, but Edinburgh Castle's been monkeyed about with a lot. There's a lot of much more modern additions and add-ons. It's been altered. Stirling Castle is, in many respects, the castle that James the Fourth built. It's still a medieval 15th, 16th century castle. And I feel it's redolent of that. Just recently, the Renaissance palace that James built for his wife, Marie de Guise, the mother of Mary, Queen of Scots, was the subject of a £12 million, I think, renovation. And it's stunning. The castle, because he was trying to impress his French-born wife, he imported, all those centuries ago, French artisans to come and build it and decorate the thing. And during the refurbishment, likewise, French craftsmen were brought in again to recreate the place. And it's one of the most impressive and evocative visitor attractions that I have visited in Britain. It's got all sorts of quirky things about it. The frontage, one of the great frontages that looks across at the Great Hall, was used for the filming of all the exteriors for Colditz, the 1970s television series. The Great Hall itself is very controversial because it's been reharled, which is a kind of a, what do you call it, a cladding, a paint, really, to weatherproof it. It's a kind of a yellow gold colour, so that from a great distance you can see the Great Hall of Stirling Castle. You can see it from miles away. And the whole castle really should be that colour, because at one point it would all have been painted, and the statuary around it would have been garish colours to our eyes. It would have been quite the edifice to be confronted with. And it has so many stories to tell. Stirling, in general, and more in particular the castle, is known locally as the brooch that fixes the Highlands to the Lowlands. Stirling Castle sits on a rock that overlooks what was, up until the modern era, the only reliable stretch of dry land for moving large groups of people or animals north or south. It was marshland, bog, morass on either side. There was just a narrow strip, really. And so anyone moving north or south through Scotland would pass the rock and pass the castle. If you controlled the castle, you had a great chance of seeing who was coming and going in Scotland. So it's incredibly important. And so it has overseen all manner of history. You know, Robert the Bruce, William Wallace, the Battle of Stirling Bridge, all manner of events unfolded. Stirling is the corruption of a Gaelic word that means the place of strife, because it was known that battles always happened there because armies converged. People used to try and round up the men of Falkirk, which is a town nearby, because they were the local hard men. They're still on gable ends in Falkirk. You'll see better mess with the devil than with the bairns of Falkirk. The idea being that the general that got to that part of Scotland first and rounded up the men of Falkirk had the best chance of winning whatever battle he had in mind because they were the local heartmen. And all of that revolves around Stirling Castle like a storm. It's all there. And when you go up there, you're looking out at where battles of the Jacobite rebellions happened, Stirling Bridge in 1297, William Wallace. You look across at the Wallace Monument on its Abbey Craig edifice, the Bannockburn Visitor Centre. You can see the saltire flying over where King Robert the Bruce had his viewpoint to watch the Edward's army approach along the Roman Road. It's brilliant.
That's an excellent case for Stirling as a great castle. We might have to ask our listeners whether they agree or whether they would nominate other castles. I'd mention Chepstow, I think, as a fantastic castle. But
Harlech, there's another cracker,
which is in your book, which is also brilliant. But we'd better shove on. I did a similar-ish project to this a few years ago when I asked 100 historians to nominate places that they thought were significant in British history. And when I'd finished that project, the one thing that struck me was that we talked a lot about places, but what we hadn't talked about was routeways, tracks, paths, channels. And I thought, actually, that was an oversight, and it missed a lot of elements of stories. And, you know, historical stories tend to be journeys, people going from one place to the other. Did you find that at all when you were working on this? Did you think, oh, I wish I could be doing more on movement?
You raise a very good point. I was recently at the Melrose, the Borders Book Festival in Melrose, and the session that I was part of was chaired by Alistair Moffat, who's a friend of mine. He's a historian. He was a television producer for a long time. His most recent book is called, I need to check this, I think it's called The Hidden Ways, and it's about that precise subject, and it's a lovely read. It's all about that. It's from many centuries past up into the modern day. It's rediscovering and following the ways that people used to move around the country, particularly in Scotland. It's great. All manner of paths and trackways and all the rest of it. Yes, you're quite right. There is a fascination. I was vaguely involved in as much as I was a local reporter in a local newspaper at the time when Glasgow University Archaeological Research Division, GARD, came and excavated on the line of an extension of the M74 motorway from north to south. And they surveyed it and then excavated as they found places of interest and significance. And what cumulatively, I mean, amongst many things that were fascinating about that project, were the fact, what was obvious was that corridor, which is still where the M74 is today, the main routeway linking north and south England and Scotland, was the routeway in the Mesolithic, for example. You know, yeah. They found places where people had created great fires and they had depressions in the ground, clay-lined, boiled water with stones and then cooked food in them. And people, all periods of Scottish history, from the first hunters right up to the modern era, that was how you got north to south. We're still on the same track that Mesolithic hunters were on. At Stirling Castle, the road is not a million miles away from where we excavated as part of the project to find the battlefield of Bannockburn, the Roman Road. The Roman Road is still there. We unearthed and revealed a beautiful section of it. You could see the camber, you could see the paving of it, you could see the guttering either side, the drainage for it. And it was the Roman Road and it pointed straight at the rock of Stirling Castle. It comes and Robert the Bruce put his men where the Bannockburn Heritage Centre is today, because it meant that he could see when they, oh, there they are, they're coming now, because the only way that people would have approached Stirling Castle, as Edward's army was trying to do to come and relieve the siege that Edward the Bruce, Robert's brother, had been prosecuting at the castle. The only way it could be relieved was by bringing up an English army. How would they come? The Roman Road, which was, by the time Edward's army was coming up in the 14th century, you know, how old was that Roman Road? And so, yes, there were various times in the course of this project and in others, I think there's wonderful stuff to be remembered and reanalyzed about the way in which people have always moved about the country, and you'd be surprised at how much of it has stayed the same.
Yeah.
obviously by doing a project like this, by identifying 100 places, you invite people to query your choices.
I hope so.
The one omission for me, the one surprising thing that you didn't include was anything to do with the Battle of Hastings or the Hastings site for the Norman Conquest. How do you defend yourself on that one?
I had 100 places to fill. And in each case, it was places that had resonated with me. Now, believe it or believe it not, I have not been on the fields that are thought to be the scene of the Battle of Hastings. I've been in Hastings many times with Coast and other projects. I've done various things there. I have not actually stood on the battlefield there. Mm-hmm. And so that would be the keynote of my defence.
Right.
It had to be somewhere or something that I had seen or handled that resonated with me.
Okay. But you do talk about Durham Cathedral, which as a sort of consequence of that, as a sort of follow-up from the invasion.
I was careful that it's 100 places, but I would hope that if whoever reads it would realise that it touches on many, many more than 100 places, because one of my motivations for the project was because I wanted to encourage people to go to places, because I think, maybe it's just because I'm childish, but I think there is something special about not just reading about an event, but going to somewhere that's physically the product of or the scene of an event. And some were harder than others. For example, when it came to, I wanted to include the Wars of the Roses. But where do you go? Because the reality is I've been at a few of the battlefields related to it and there is nothing to see. It's difficult. And when you go to Towton, the great charnel house of the Wars of the Roses, there's not much to see. I didn't find it a particularly resonant location. Maybe other people would go to it and think, no, I can smell the blood in the air. I don't know. But it didn't work for me. So I chose Westminster Abbey, and specifically the tomb of Margaret Beaufort, mother of Henry VII, grandmother of Henry VIII, because I felt that, and I've been there, and I think, I remember being by that tomb and thinking, God, somewhere in there are the bones of a little woman. Because she was, according to all the accounts, she was of small stature, and yet she was some impressive human being. You know, she was pregnant at 12, had her baby at 13, her only child, and she saw him onto the... She saw it. He was the ultimate victor of the Wars of the Roses, and then his son was Henry VIII, for goodness sake. The Tudor line comes out of her, and I felt that I got some sense of... I thought, well, I can't go to the... I don't get it from the battlefields, but I thought here is a kind of a nerve centre for something that was significant to do with the Wars of the Roses. So I hope that I'm giving people one place, and then from that there are dotted lines going. Now I could talk about the battlefield at Towton, and you can. And there is a little stone cross. Well, it's not little, but it's you could overlook it. But there are many more than 100 places. I would hope that the 100 places are the key to 1,000 places or more.
So we're almost out of time, and we've. Barely, we've only got halfway through the story, really. Less than halfway. So
you have to buy the book.
There's loads more in the second half. I would have loved to have talked to you about Penley and Mousel and that story. The
loss of the Solomon Brown.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and everyone should read that one. But you go right up to the present day. But sort of in conclusion, are there maybe five places that you would pick where? Specifically where they're really good to visit. Where would you go for a really good visitor experience?
For a really good visitor experience? How dare you ask me such an impossible question? I could only narrow down my favourite places to 100, and that was a struggle. Let me think. Off the top of my head, where were Stirling Castle.
Of course.
If you want a sense of that world, and that world from which so much else sprung. I mean, apart from anything else, James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England on the death of Elizabeth I, was educated in a room in Stirling Castle. He knew it. I mean, and that's so much of British history. It's like a bottleneck. There's so much of Scottish and British history passes through it and goes off to its eventual destination. So definitely go and see Stirling Castle. The Fortingall Yew, or Glen Lyon which is Walter Scott described it as the loneliest, the loveliest glen in Scotland. It's a, for people that are interested in the landscape of Scotland, of Britain, it's a beauty. Anyway, just go there to see the landscape. But within it, there is Glen Lyon. There are various locations within it that tell moving stories about history. And there's the Fortingall Yew, which most tree scientists are happy that it's at least 3,000 years old, but there's some speculation that it could be the oldest living thing in Europe. And how do you prove a thing like that? And I just allow for the possibility. So go and see the Fortingall Yew. Imagine that. It may have been growing there before the archipelago was even an archipelago. It may have been there when Britain was still attached to the mainland Europe. So it's always been there. We'd go and see that. That's two. A lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of people in Scotland would probably give me pelters for this, but I would say the Greenwich Museum, to go and stand beside the statue of Wolfe, because it is the best view of London. It's not just me saying that. I think a lot of people would. It's the only place, or it's the best place where you can go and you can get the sense of it almost being tabletop sized. You can just stand and without moving your head, you can take in London and consider this a 2,000 years of significance that that place has had, not just to England, but to Britain and to the world, London. So I'd go and see. And of course, by being there, you're at the Greenwich Observatory. You're where time begins and ends. There's the story of Wolfe. There's stories of the Tudors, all of it orbiting around that place. So that's three.
There's a bit going on there, I would agree.
There's a bit going on there. You mentioned the Penley lifeboat. I wanted the book to consider the human, the small, although I don't mean that in any sense to diminish, significance of the story of Britain. The Penley lifeboat went out on a distress call and all the boat was lost, the eight lifeboatmen were lost, and the eight lives of the boat that they were trying to help, they were all lost. And it's still the last time that the RNLI lost all men, all at one go. And hopefully it's the very last time that that will ever happen, because that was an appalling tragedy. But when you go there to Mousel, Mouse Hole, as it actually looks, but they call it Mousel down there, and the boathouse is there, and it's been empty ever since, and there's a little garden, and every year on the anniversary of the tragedy in December, all the town lights are turned off in remembrance of those men that went out. And I find there's a line that I quote in it from a letter from a US Air Force pilot who was on secondment at the time, and he was there, and he witnessed it, and he described them as the greatest eight men he had ever seen, because he witnessed it from his helicopter, although he couldn't help. And to some extent, I find it the most moving story of them all, because, you know, the RNLI's volunteer. Most people are out there risking their lives as volunteers because they feel it's the right thing to do. And I find that there's something about the existence of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution and the kind of people, men and women, who volunteer for it, which says something profound about the human spirit. So I would go and see that, because it's just a little stone building, really, but it holds something that should be cherished. So that's four.
One more.
The Ness of Brodgar.
Okay.
Archaeological site still being excavated, might be being excavated forever because it's vast, on the archipelago of Orkney. It's Neolithic. It's the single best archaeological discovery, I would say, in my lifetime, because I'm interested in the Neolithic particularly. I like the Neolithic of Britain and of Scotland, so it ticks a lot of boxes for me. Its discovery and its ongoing excavation is having archaeologists around the world reconsider the Neolithic of Europe. People were up there 5,000 years ago doing something incredibly meaningful to them. They were building, they were creating buildings, they were decorating those buildings, they were using them, they were domestic, they were ritual, all manner of things were going on in that place. And it's a reminder, apart from anything else, that at different times, different places in Britain have been hugely important. And I like to indulge the possibility that places like the Ness, as Stonehenge, as Avebury, as the tombs at Knowth, might have been famous while they were being used, not just in Britain, not just in Ireland, not just in Scotland, but they might have drawn people from around the world, that people might have been coming to them on pilgrimage, like a Lourdes. People south of the Alps would have gone, before I die, I'm going to see whatever they called the Ness of Brodgar. It must have had a name. I'm going to go there. It must have drawn people because they would have known. So there's my five.
I would agree. Orkney, absolutely amazing place to visit. One last question. If your publishers had allowed you an extra three pages, four pages, what would be 101, site 101, that didn't get in? Oh,
God, these are terrible questions. Site 101. Where are we? Let me just take an aerial view of Britain and see where I would go for another story. Oh, I might go to Flag Fen.
Brilliant.
Because I'm an archaeologist like you. I've visited Flag Fen. It was nearly in. What on earth was going on there? That causeway, like a motorway, built across the fenland in Cambridgeshire. People depositing metalwork and all sorts of other things that we would never find because they wouldn't all have been made of metal. That was some response to a changing landscape by people just like us, but whose circumstances were impossibly different and really impossible to imagine. But what a story Flag Fen tells.
Yeah.
And you can go and see it because, God bless them, the archaeologists there. There's a building over a whole section of it, and you can go in and see these blackened timbers that are just as they were, still there.
Yeah, the waterlogged deposits, amazing, amazing survivals. Right, we must finish. Neil, thank you so much. That was brilliant. The book is out on the 20th of September, published by Bantam, and you're also doing a tour around Britain, which starts in Harrogate on the 1st of October and goes around the country, 39 places, and details are at neiloliver.com/talks.html. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Neil Oliver. The story of the British Isles in 100 places has just been published by Bantam Press. And if it whets your appetite for this kind of treatment of British history, then you may also want to check out the BBC History magazine book, 100 Places That Made Britain, which was written by Dave Musgrove, and it has recently been re-released in a paperback edition. OK, well, that is about all for today, but do listen in again on Thursday for more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.